So, all right, what movie is that from?
What?
What movie is that from?
You didn't
from?
Do anything. You just made a terrible noise.
This is episode 46. I'm your host, Byron. And tonight, in celebration of the season, we're reviewing the October Society's Tales of Halloween, 10 frightening fables from LA's darkest directors. One in particular, Lucky McKee, was kind enough to chat with me about Halloween, as well as his segment, Ding Dong. And you're going to hear our conversation later in the show. Also, we check into Southern California's paranormally infamous and homicidally hospitable Cecil Hotel in this week's edition of Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies. I'm joined tonight by Kelly.
Yo, yo.
And Sam.
Hey, guys.
Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
Indeed it is.
It's been one whole year. It may not seem like it.
Since we recorded our first episode.
Okay.
Yeah, we need to be clear on this.
Well, let's celebrate on Halloween.
It's a big deal.
Please?
I mean, it is a big deal. Yeah. It's just weird because it's not our 52nd episode, so that's the only reason I'm pointing it out.
I mean, yeah.
There were a few weeks where we took naps instead.
Well, no, there were no weeks where we did that, actually. See, that's I want to take credit for the fact that we didn't do that. The point is, from the first air date, that's why I'm saying we have two anniversaries. This is our first anniversary.
We've been sitting in this room for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
Trapped.
We should get out.
We should leave the room.
I don't mind it.
Looks like somebody left a saw over there, a hacksaw. Well,
no, there's not. No need.
Do you guys remember that scene with the cinder block in Saw?
Mm-hmm.
God, I love it so much. Mm-hmm. It's been a very long time since I've seen that movie.
Yeah, I don't do those ones.
You don't saw?
Nope.
So you're not coming to saw on logs?
Well, I mean, I really like the idea. I love outdoor film festivals.
Have you told people what Saw and Logs
Saw and
is?
Saw Logs is my film festival where I watch all of the Saw films in order from dusk till dawn, which I think technically there's too much Saw
to cram into that.
To cram into that, but I also assume that no one's going to watch that much Saw.
What I mean, it's got to be. It's a week's worth of movies.
Enough about a movie I saw a long time ago.
Saw. That was so funny.
Oh, it's great being in this room with you.
Yeah, Matt, I know.
Sliding by
hey,
Kelly.
Hey, guys. I really like Let's being talk- in this room with you, too.
Let's please talk about movies we saw this week. I watched a movie called I Spit on Your Grave 3, Vengeance is Mine.
Ooh. Is vengeance indeed yours?
I got absolutely nothing from this movie. Jennifer Butler reprises her role from the first film in the reboot, making this the reboot's true sequel. Quality-wise, I don't think it really matches up.
What year?
Yeah. This one came out this year. Just came out. Yep. Jennifer, after surviving multiple brutal rapes and physical assaults, is severely traumatized and untrusting and defensive towards all men, even the good ones, including a very nice gentleman in her office. She joins a support group at the recommendation of her therapist. She meets this girl named Marla. They begin this kind of crusade helping the victims in their support group. But things take a pretty sharp turn when Marla is murdered by her ex-boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer goes off the deep end. Not a good movie.
Great.
I don't know why I watch these movies. I've seen them all. I guess I'm chasing that true reboot from the 1978 film, which isn't even really a good movie. But I think it's something that horror fans need to see.
It was pretty fucking brutal for the time.
In fact, it was voted Time Magazine's, I don't know what it was, in the top 10 of ridiculously violent movies in 2010, which was the same year of the original reboot. So I think it also holds the record for longest rape scene in a film.
Oh, God.
It's a dubious honor.
Yeah, I need to quit watching these.
Well, somebody has to, Byron.
I guess. I do need to write a review for this on FrightDay.com. The Walking Dead this season.
Oh, we're on last season, so don't spoil.
Oh
my God, I can't believe that.
Please, don't you dare. I know there was something big that happened this week, so don't say anything.
Well, I have a theory about that, which I'd love to talk.
No, don't.
I'm not going to. But if I did talk to you about it, I would sound probably like Kelly, because I have a theory that something's...
Oh, good, a theory.
Something's happening that they're not telling us.
A theory is just science without facts.
What have you guys been watching?
We actually have been catching up on the previous season of Walking Dead.
What do you think?
I mean, it's hard to say anything at all without giving things away.
Sure.
I was happy that we get to find out more about Beth.
I love Beth.
I don't want to say anything more than that.
You know I love Beth.
I know. That's a different
episode.
Of course
you do.
Anything else?
Yeah. I actually read a comic called Green Wake. Originally scheduled to run for 25 issues. Ran for 11 because it didn't sell as well as it was anticipated. I think because it is way too smart for the vast majority of
That's a call out.
Yeah, I think so. This comic is absolutely phenomenal. It's by Curtis Weeb and Riley Rossmo. I don't even really know how to describe it. It's like a gothic, noir, Lovecraftian murder mystery.
That's your shit.
Yeah, it's so good. The art in it is absolutely phenomenal.
Just toss that my way.
There you go. The idea is people wake up in this town called Green Wake, and they don't know how they got there. They don't know anything about the town except it's where they are. And there's just weird things happening that are just run-of-the-mill, just like, again, strange Lovecraftian creatures that inhabit this town. And there are these two individuals who have taken it upon themselves to kind of be the detectives of Green Wake when shit starts to go seriously awry and there's a series of really grisly murders and they have to figure out what happened. But it's shockingly well written. Every panel is, worth very close examination. And I actually felt like I was reading one of those. I don't know if you ever read any like the puzzle books when you were a kid where you have to glean the details from the little bits and pieces in the corners of the panels. Like Graham Bass, like the 11th Hour.
Animalia. I don't know what that is.
But you're so engaged actively in this work that you feel like you're solving these mysteries with Morley Mack and Krieger. It's work. You have to be fully engaged to get the most out of this comic. And to me, that's the highest recommendation that you can make for a graphic novel. I recommend the shit out of this. You can pick up the entire run in 2 trade paperbacks because, as I said, it was canceled.
We'll link it on the show notes. I think that's a great thing to start pushing. Also, was the story affected by being cut short, or did they find a way to wrap it up?
No. They didn't really anticipate the cancellation, so Okay. Be prepared to not be satisfied.
Just be super bummed.
I would say, yeah.
Cool. That's you a glowing more. Recommendation. Buy something you'll be dissatisfied with. But it sounds like it's worth the journey, even if the journey's not completed.
I felt that it was.
No hope for a future...
I don't think so. I think it's moments past, and we have what we have.
Terribly sad. I just remembered, I watched a couple other things. I watched Crimson Peak with my mom.
Oh, awesome. Okay, so what did you think?
Oh, that's not really appropriate for this story.
Yeah, I like Nancy.
She's the best. As you may have heard, not a horror film, really. Some gothicness and some ghosts are there, but as they say in the actual movie, it's not a ghost story. It's a story with ghosts. Visually, it's great. The set and the costumes are amazing. The cast is great.
Was
but
it as atmospheric as it looked from the trailers?
Yeah, sure. There's something.
Period pieces aren't your jam.
That's true. But something's wrong with the story that it just kind of floats a little bit. It's not as gripping as I would have wanted it to be. But beside the strain, I'm not a huge Guillermo del Toro fan. So maybe you'd love this. It seems like it's something you might be interested in, for
sure. Still check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Check it out. I mean, anytime there's a major horror release that isn't The Green Inferno, go check it out. Have I even talked about The Green Inferno on this show?
No.
Oh, God.
I was in Omaha, Nebraska, and I had the opportunity to watch The Green Inferno. And, I mean, Blumhouse made the right call, probably financially, I would imagine. They made their money on this, but he did not make the right call in content. Maybe I should rewatch Hostel and really think about why Eli Roth is such an
icon, an impresario.
Yeah, it's just not a good movie.
Nothing. I mean, Hemlock Grove is fucking...
I only saw 3 episodes of Hemlock Grove.
It's so incredibly meh.
And the weirdest thing is I also this week had the chance to watch his other film, Knock Knock, starring Keanu Reeves.
I think that looks like it could be a really interesting idea.
Strange thing, much better film than The Green Inferno. Hold tight. Not a great film.
But just better than...
Yeah. Keanu, it feels like he kind of was thrown into this last minute. I think he's a great actor. I think John Wick was an amazing film. He didn't seem very prepared for this. And I mean, probably for what he was getting paid, I wouldn't blame him.
He phoned it in.
But it's an interesting concept, and I found myself extremely stressed out throughout the entire movie. So save your money. Don't buy The Green Inferno on DVD. Don't go see it in theaters. Actually, I'm f***ing up a bit.
Where are you going with this, Byron?
Spend it on this VOD movie. Get Knock Knock. And I'm sure this will be a Redbox movie, too, because it's kind of that movie. It's an erotic thriller horror. I just can't recommend that movie more and The Green Inferno less. This has been my Eli rant.
That was a good rant.
Appreciate that.
I would also like to talk about a movie we had the opportunity to screen called Classroom 6.
Oh, cool. Yeah, you wrote a review for that on Friday.com.
I did.
It's our website.
Yeah, we have
where you could go, I mean, to see all of the latest trailers, movie reviews, and breaking news.
Yeah.
That was a plug for our website.
That was so subtle. Well, you just slipped it right in there.
I know.
That was just the tip of a promo.
Listen, I've been doing this for a year.
Sam.
Classroom 6.
Classroom 6, directed by Jonas Odenheimer.
Do you see all this coffee?
Holy cow. At least it was cold.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
God. Man, I'm sorry.
It's all right. Let's go.
I hate found footage horror, POV stuff, because it's all bad.
I mean, it's not true, but...
It's not true. It's a bit of an exaggeration, but not much. Classroom 6 is a, on the surface, it seems like everything that makes the genre bad. It's a budding reporter on a lock-in overnight haunting assignment.
Quarantine. Wreck.
Yeah.
It is kind of wreckish, but I thought it was better.
But somehow it manages to be kind of more than the sum of its parts. Shot on an extremely low budget. They shot it for $5,000.
Wait, that's how much catering was?
Craft services was $5,000.
That's pretty normal. That makes sense. No, what kind of budget?
The whole movie cost them $5,000 to make.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you.
Cheese sandwiches.
Exactly.
That's what they did at Troma. Did you know that?
Cheese sandwiches.
Yeah, just cheese and bread.
Huh.
But...
Well, that's where all the money went.
Sure, it went to the bread and the cheese.
Uncle Lloyd.
Oh, fuck.
I felt that this movie was the first true reboot of the genre back to the Blair Witch roots. Very indie, very guerrilla style. I would say amateur acting almost to the point where it seemed like they weren't acting.
That's what people are looking for when they're looking for amateur actors.
I absolutely. The scares were genuine. They built up. There weren't a lot of jump scares or the... What do we call the...
Jumping stairs, where you skip one?
The jumping stairs? Yeah, that one.
Okay.
No, the sound, like the sound...
What, the sound zooms?
Yeah.
What were we calling them? We've got a name for them.
It's a good name.
Yeah, I'll think about it.
And it's just a scary, great ghost story. I am extremely excited to see what Mr. Odenheimer goes on to do from here. This is one that Blumhouse could have picked up and made millions of dollars off of.
Yeah, when you look at movies like The Gallows.
Oh, fuck The Gallows,
We've ranted plenty of about The Gallows. I approached this director about his movie after watching the trailer, which at the time I had no idea that the budget was $5,000. You know, it looked like a legit indie film, and it's incredible that you can get something like that for a budget of $5,000, which is something that other movies like The Gallows probably spent on porta potties or something like that.
And they basically had like 2 12-hour days or something of shooting, just some insanely limited amount of time to get it all done. I'm so impressed by what they accomplished with the budget and the time constraints that they were facing. I think it's worth a watch strictly on those merits.
I haven't had the chance to see it yet. Where can other people see it?
You can check it out now on iTunes, Amazon, and Xbox.
Very cool. Support that kind of stuff. $5,000. Can't get over it. Kelly, have you seen anything this week?
I actually started watching a movie called Dark Places, which Sam tells me doesn't count as a horror movie, but it's a Charlize Theron movie that came out that's kind of a, I don't know, it's like a murder horror mystery.
In the meantime, though, you've been writing...
Catching up on The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And I have put together a kick-ass list of 13 movies you should watch on Halloween.
Which listeners aren't going to get to benefit from. because this comes out past Halloween, but
well, no, because
I'm proposing something.
The list is going up first.
Well, I know, but I'm saying the listeners.
Right.
Hopefully you're going to FrightDay.com on a daily basis, but if you're not,
you should be.
It's going to be Halloween forever now. Are you okay with that? Halloween, it's called
Halloween. What about Christmas?
I think we're just going to do Halloween. It. Thank you, Sam.
But I like Christmas too, guys.
It's just
and
Halloween.
And the motion carries.
Halloween
it's
forever.
Always Halloween.
Great.
Halloween time all the time.
So what do you say we get into the Halloween spirit a bit? I was lucky enough to talk to one of the directors of Tales of Halloween, as well as the director of films like The Woman or May or All Cheerleaders Must Die.
You were lucky enough.
Yeah, I talked to a gentleman by the name of Lucky McKee, and let's listen to that now. So Lucky, how did you become involved with the Tales of Halloween project?
Axel Carolyn, the creator and chief creative producer, called me up after they'd already kind of put everything together and just asked me if I wanted to join in the fun. And I said, hell yeah, what a great group of people to be involved with. So Axel, who had been friends with me for years, so it was cool we finally got to work on something together.
Yeah, very cool. I actually don't know too much about Axel. How did you guys meet?
I first met her along the film festival circuit. She's a great horror journalist and eventually started, you know, making her own short films and made her first feature, Soulmate, recently. You know, you should look her up, though, man. She's awesome. I don't know. Have you seen the film? Have you seen Tales of Halloween yet?
I did. I loved it.
Okay,
yeah.
She just did the Grim Grinning Ghost segment, which has the best jump scares in the movie, I think.
Oh, yeah. That was definitely a standout for me.
No, she's awesome, man. You're gonna be seeing plenty from that lady. She's amazing. Strong, strong voice horror.
This anthology is credited as the October Society's Tales of Halloween. Can you explain what the October Society is?
I don't know. I was kind of told about that as I was brought into the thing. I guess, you know, the idea is this is a bunch of us that, you know, hang out and share ideas and are always, you know, just horror buddies, just like all the rest of us, you know, like you have your group of friends that you share this love of horror movies with and stuff like that. This group of people all just happen, you know, to not only be horror geeks, but we also, you know, fortunate being able to make these things. So just a group of friends, really.
Yeah.
A group of geeks.
I love it. Horror is one of the few genres that allows this sort of collaboration. Were there any rules or limitations going into the project?
There were no real constraints. I mean, it was just parameters, you know, that were designed by Axel and Mike and the rest of the team in terms of, what we liked about anthology movies and what we thought worked and didn't work about anthology movies. And, you know, the idea of having this film all take place in the same town and have some of the characters kind of bleed over into the different segments and bringing it together with, you know, the Adrian Barbeau doing the DJ thing and, you know, all, you know, a lot of it just came from the love of what we grew up on.
When you were growing up, what were some of your favorite anthologies?
Well, obviously, Creepshow. And, one of my personal favorites is Cat's Eye, the Louis Teague film. I'm a big fan of Louis Teague's films, Cujo Alligator and Cat's Eye. So that was a big influence. Short story collections of Stephen King, I think, were a big influence. Short story collections in general. Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Twilight Zone, you know, all of the classics. And then, you know, for me, even other anthology movies like New York Stories that Scorsese, Coppola, and Woody Allen did. It's an amazing anthology movie. And in fact, contains one of my favorite Scorsese films, Life Lessons. And then there's a De Sica film called Woman Times Seven that's really cool. And it's got Shirley MacLaine playing seven different women in seven different short stories. Yeah, those are just a smattering of some of my favorites.
One of my favorite things about doing these interviews is I always leave with a list of movies that I haven't seen yet that I need to.
Awesome. Cool. I'm here to help.
I appreciate it. So you directed the segment Ding Dong. Could you briefly explain what it's all about?
Yeah, it's Ding Dong centers on a young man and young woman who are a childless couple dealing with Halloween night. Little, you know, this woman really, really wants a child, and she's kind of gets driven more and more mad by the fact that all these cute little children are showing up at her doorstep trick-or-treating. And the husband, she's sort of an abusive woman, and there's this growing fear and dread because the thing is told from her husband's perspective, and he's terrified of this woman, and he sees her as this red witch. And it all just kind of like culminates in sort of like a surreal subconscious insanity, I guess is the best way I can describe it.
The subject matter in Ding Dong is much darker than a lot of the other segments. Where did you draw inspiration for it?
Just stuff that whenever I come up with a story, it's kind of stuff that I've been personally or observing personally or just thinking about, just ideas, and I know that, for a lot of young couples there, especially married couples, eventually, the issue of should we have children or should we not have children comes up. And also I'm also interested in the dynamic of relationships, between, two people in love, in terms of who's dominant, who's submissive, and the blurred lines in between those two, two sort of things. So it's just, it's all just kind of stuff that's just whatever is kind of swirling in my brain on the day that I have to sit down and write something.
For sure. So darkness aside, you still find a way to inject some humor into this. Why do you think those two emotions work so well together?
Tension release, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people say that, but it actually does help, life isn't all just bad, it's like you can be having like the shittiest day and then you can all of a sudden see something beautiful or your dog will do something stupid and it changes everything. So just trying to give it that kind of vibrance of life. Life isn't always just one tone. It's many tones at the same time. And it's like whatever your mental state, whatever your mental state is, you grasp onto the things that you're feeling and react to the things that maybe you're not. So,
what are your thoughts on horror films that have like intensely dislikable characters or unrelenting dread?
There's just some really, there's a film like Martyrs, which I think is brilliant, but man, it's fucking dark through and through, I didn't find myself laughing a lot when I was watching Martyrs,
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe I should have, I don't know.
No,
something, but,
I'm with you.
Yeah, films like that, which I think are great, I think that's a very, very powerful, visceral film.
Speaking of powerful, visceral films, you had a chance to work with Pollyanna McIntosh on this film, as well as your other film, The Woman. She has such an amazing range. What's it like working with her again?
That was awesome. I mean, when The Woman, she's just covered in mud and dirt, wearing like rags the whole time, and this actually got to, she actually, got to be just something. And two iterations of her character, her character and then also the way her husband sees her, which is this red witch. So it was just fun to, take her through a couple more characters and be able to do two in one, even in a short film was really fun. I mean, she's got such range and just such a vibrance on film that it was, she's just a delight to work with, and especially after going through the grind of making The Woman, it was cool to just like check back in with each other and see what we each learned from the stuff we've done since we made The Woman. And yeah, I mean, she's just a delight. It's like working with Wonder Woman. She's just a delightful, delightful person.
It's great to hear that. I thought she did such a great job in Let Us Pray earlier this year.
I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh, absolutely. Check it out. It's great.
Oh, yeah, I will. Yeah, she's an amazing creative force, that woman.
So watching Tales of Halloween from here on out is going to be a Halloween tradition at my house. Is there anything you have to do every year to make the season complete?
I don't know. I mean, I'm still kind of into the candy thing,
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess every day is Halloween when it comes to candy. I eat too much chocolate. I don't know if there's anything. It's kind of different every year, you know. I just kind of take it as it goes, you know. This is going to be a really special Halloween because it's my second film that, has a Halloween theme in it, because May, you know, the whole third act of May takes place on Halloween night, so it's kind of fun to jump back into that world on film. So,
do you have a favorite Halloween film?
God, my favorite Halloween. Do I have a favorite Halloween film? I don't know. I can't think of one right now. I'm terrible. Name some off. What's your favorite?
Halloween, House of a Thousand Corpses, Trick or Treat.
I haven't seen Trick or Treat. Everybody keeps bringing that up in relation to this. I guess I should watch it.
You should check it out.
I know. Everybody speaks so highly of it. It's just one I haven't gotten around to. You know? There's 130 years of movies to go through. I can't see them all.
Welcome to my nightmare. Yeah.
I love it.
Are you working on anything currently that you can talk about?
Yeah, I'm writing a little thriller that is kind of in the vein or tone of something like May or Roman that I'm really excited about. It's a story I've wanted to tell for a really long time. I'm going to make that film next year, fingers crossed. I can't say what the title of it is or what it's about yet, but I'm really excited about it. It's a really cool personal story. And writing a big, fantastic film with Chris Severson that's just been a gas to work on. So cool. And then Jack Ketchum and I wrote a full-length novel called Healer that'll be coming out pretty soon that I'm super excited about. It's one of those I want to make it before I die sort of stories, something I've been wanting to tell for a long time, and really, really excited about it. It's about a little girl and her has a psychic connection with her dog. So hopefully I'll be making that one within the next year or two. So lots of stuff, just trying to keep busy.
Yeah, incredible. I know we're all excited here at Fright Day for whatever you do next.
Right on, man. Thanks.
Is there anywhere our listeners could reach you on social media?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. At Lucky McKee. That's me.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Lucky. Congratulations on Tales of Halloween, and hopefully we can talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks a lot, man.
You know what I wish I would have been around to ask him after watching Ding Dong?
What's that?
I want to know if there's some horrific female character in his history that inspired that wretched literal witch.
Pretty intense stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I guess everybody has like a bad breakup story, but it'd be fun to know like what his inspiration was for the horrible, evil female.
Thanks so much, Lucky, for sitting down and talking to me. Maybe next time my co-host here will be in town.
I'm sorry.
Just eating cheese curds on the sea.
Hey, it's what we do.
You know what I've been doing since I got back to try and get over those cheese curds? I've been lunging everywhere.
Okay.
Instead of walking, I've been lunging.
That's a tip you're giving people.
Yep, just lunge. Takes a little bit longer to get places, yeah, but it's
and
great.
And is terrifying to watch.
Sure.
You don't know what's going on.
Yeah, there were some people that were giving me funny looks.
If Kelly lunges up behind you in a dark sidewalk.
Yeah, not into it. But you know what I am into is the fucking Cecil Hotel.
I know.
Kelly, you made my day.
Yeah? Well, it is good. So this is one of those great stories, Byron.
In this week's edition of Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies.
So Byron, this is one of those great stories in Captain Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies that represents a union of our interests.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Kelly.
So because the Cecil clearly has a great haunted history, but it also has a serial killer history. Therefore, ooh, both of us can be happy.
I'm thrilled.
So we're going to walk through the history of the Cecil. We're going to talk about some current events at the Cecil, including a couple recent terrifying reviews of people who have stayed at the Cecil.
Really?
Really.
I mean, do I get a chance to share the story I've shared three times on this show?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
The Cecil Hotel has recently been renamed the Stay on Main for reasons that will become apparent later in this historical overview.
Okay.
Right?
Lame name.
Well, yeah. The Stay on Main, pretty lame.
Come on now.
So it's on 640 South Main Street in downtown Los Angeles. 600 guest rooms, originally 700. Not sure what happened to that 100 because everybody talks about the rooms being really tiny even now. So I'm not sure what happened, but it was constructed in 1924, opened a couple years later, and it was intended for business travelers. They started building it when this part of the city was really in its prime, but by the time they opened it, it was already on kind of the downward spin.
Downtown Los Angeles.
It's right by Skid Row. Yeah. Everybody knows what Skid Row is.
It's a
band. You don't want to go there.
It's an 80s band.
Yeah, but it's like bad.
Every rose has its thorn.
I think that's Poison.
Shit. Same thing.
All I know is my dad always referred to Skid Row as a bad place when I was a child.
See, the thing is, downtown LA, it used to be some place that people went.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the Fabric District is kind of down there where people buy fabrics.
I do like fabrics.
That's pretty much it.
I love fabrics.
I might be wrong. I've been to LA a couple times, but...
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Sure.
Essentially, after it opened... It quickly...
Hold tight. I just got a message from one of our writers, Felicia, and she's currently watching a movie called Condemned, and she says she's 60 out of the 80 minutes in and legitimately can't finish it. She might actually throw up. Don't know if that's a good or bad thing. Just wanted to get that out there for our listeners.
I'm thinking that's a good thing. No, I need to watch
Felicia,
Condemned now.
I'm so sorry. Now you can feel my pain. After a very brief prime... time for this hotel.
Okay. Big space between those words.
Well, it outlived its prime very quickly, okay. I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Late 20s, it quickly became a place for business travelers. And then by the 1950s, it had kind of devolved into a place where transients like to stay.
Okay.
So a nice way of saying it. But here's some interesting...
As well as actresses and actors.
True. Most of us are familiar with the Black Dahlia murder, not just the band, but the event. Elizabeth Short, the victim, stayed at the Cecil Hotel. Her body was found 8 blocks from the Cecil Hotel. I did not know that until I started
doing this research. How was her body found, Kelly?
Well, it was mutilated.
Uh-huh. How badly?
Pretty badly.
Moderately.
I think she was split in two.
Scale of 1 to 10, a 10.
You think?
Yeah.
She was a torso.
Yeah, yeah. She was a torso. And
it was
actually
severed at the waist, completely drained of blood, corners of the mouth carved to her ears, and a very terrifying smile.
Is that technically a Chelsea grin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's creepy. Both of you know that. And they still don't know who did it. Unsolved mystery, even today.
Oh, man.
Very interesting. That was not where the horror of the Cecil Hotel stopped, however. Lots to go. Another death occurred in 1954. A woman named Helen Gurney jumped from the 7th floor window onto the hotel marquee below. In 1962, Julia Moore jumped from her room on the 8th floor, leaving only behind a bus ticket and a bank book with $1,800 in it. There was no suicide note, so that's another one where they're wondering what actually happened. Then a few months later, before you jumped the gun...
I'm just going to say, I wonder how many people don't write suicide notes. I think that's interesting.
I don't think many. I mean, it's got to be a really spur of the moment thing which seems weird.
Or you just don't care.
Maybe that's it.
I mean, when you get to that point.
Do you? But I feel like maybe, I don't know. Pauline Otten, a few months after Julia Moore jumped to her death, also jumped to her death from a hotel window on the 9th floor.
It's catching on.
Yeah, she had an argument with her estranged husband and decided to take the plunge. However, she landed on a 62-year-old passerby, and both of them died instantly.
Oof.
Grim.
That is grim.
Ooh, sad trombone.
Yeah. Then this is the next unsolved murder that happened. In 1964, a woman known as the Pigeon Woman, her real name was Goldie Osgood, she fed the birds. So I'm going to tie this back to Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
Fantastic film.
Great film.
I'll allow it.
So picture in your mind the Pigeon Woman from that movie.
Yeah.
But this poor woman.
Who's Kevin McAllister in this situation?
Maybe the murderer that they didn't find.
Nickname Pigeon Woman.
Well, but she doesn't need a corner office. She's happy with her corner room at the Cecil Hotel. However, she wasn't happy when she was found dead in her room where she had been stabbed, strangled, and raped, and her room had been ransacked. Again, still unsolved to this day.
Boof. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So here's where we get into the stuff that Byron likes.
I do.
Yep.
I do?
You do.
I jumped in a bit too early.
These
I don't know.
These are terrible things.
I mean, you really do. This is where you really, really
okay.
like it.
Okay. What's up?
All right. So 1984.
Sounds like a good year for a serial killer.
Yep. Serial killer Richard Ramirez. Stayed at the Cecil Hotel.
The Night Stalker.
Yep. Obviously, one of America's most notorious killers, Byron can tell you all sorts of lovely things about
him. I just
him.
Know a couple silly things.
So I'll give you some background on him because I am going to do a little bit of background just for Byron's
sake.
As
a kid, he slept in graveyards.
Well, he had an abusive father.
Where did you sleep?
I mean, not in a graveyard.
He had an abusive father and
mausoleum.
His cousin.
Roof over the top.
His cousin had fought in the Vietnam War, and his cousin was kind of a role model to him since his dad beat the shit out of him. His cousin told him all these stories about people he had killed in Vietnam, women he'd raped there, and because this is who Ramirez looked up to, he thought, wow, that sounds really great. I should probably do those things. And the cousin also murdered his wife in front of Ramirez.
He did.
Yeah.
Bad guy.
Interesting, one of Ramirez's first jobs was working at a hotel in Texas, of course, where he was raised, not the Cecil Hotel. But he became very familiar with the format of the hotel, and a lot of people think that that's why he decided this would be a great place to stay rather than having his own location, because in terms of disposing of bloody clothes and whatnot, it became much easier staying at a hotel because it wasn't necessarily tied to him. Whereas if you're disposing of those things at a residence, it has to be tied to the person that's living there.
I do have to say, he also probably didn't have enough money to be
that's
in a
true.
Residence.
He was staying in a $14 a night room.
He's a bit of a dirtbag.
You don't see very many of those around anymore. Not a lot of the $14 special rooms.
Well, way back when he was in Texas at this hotel, he was even caught then trying to assault some of the patrons. Charges were never pushed to a point where he was convicted, obviously. Dropped out of high school, moved to California, and thus began his crime spree. So his first murder was a 9-year-old girl.
Yeah, he's really a bad dude.
Really pretty bad. Then he began his career as the Night Stalker, which actually the media named him. He did not pick that up. He wanted to be called either the Walk-In Killer or the Valley Intruder.
Which, I mean, I don't know, debatably cooler names. The Night Stalker's pretty good, though.
Yeah, Night Stalker seems way cooler. I mean, he's horrible, but so he attacked people in both San Francisco and Los Angeles.
He used to take a bit of a trip up and down.
Yeah, when you're drifting around, I suppose it's harder to get caught. So he's believed to have killed 14 people, but not all the people he attacked died.
Mm-mm, bad at it.
He would break into homes, rape, torture, murder.
He used to also, before he killed them, he'd make them say they loved Satan, and then he would kill them.
Even if they only kind of liked him?
Yeah, it's not a good thing.
He was clearly a pretty messed up person.
He also was really into AC/DC, which I don't get it.
That's a problem.
It's a bad band.
So 13 of the 14 murders were committed while he was staying at the Cecil Hotel. And yeah, he would just throw his bloody clothes in the dumpster outside the hotel before returning back to his room. Even if anybody found those bloody clothes, they're not going to be tied to him because there are a bunch of D-bags staying in this hotel. Who knows which D-bag?
Rain hell!
Okay.
So jock jams are what killed the people, basically.
I guess so. Right. Bad stuff.
Right. So unfortunately, Ramirez did not die of the death sentence that he was given. He died of B-cell lymphoma. There were some interesting last words that he had. I'm trying to find them. It was something about, he was sentenced to death in a gas chamber in 89. When he got that sentence in the courtroom, his quote was, "Big deal. Death always went with the territory. See you in Disneyland." I really don't like that he threw Disneyland into the mix there.
Yeah, he's kind of trying to bum everyone out about Disney.
Yeah. Now I'm always going to have that thought when I'm writing that Matterhorn bobsleds.
Oh, please don't say that. Please don't say that. Okay, so Byron, I don't know if you know about the second serial killer that stayed there.
You know, I don't know much about this. I know you mentioned it before the show, but
so it's kind of interesting. 6 years later, another serial killer stayed there. This one heralding from one of my favorite cities in all the world, Vienna.
Sure. Good place.
It's all schnitzel. Oh,
that
schnitzel.
We all know you love schnitzel.
Oh, God. Yep. No, I just want schnitzel. Okay. Man named...
It's 11 p.m. You don't need schnitzel right now.
I don't need anything, actually. I just need sleep.
Yeah.
Jack Underwerger. Underwerger?
Fun.
A journalist from Austria. He was a serial killer. Well, maybe not a serial killer. He was a killer back in his home country. And he first murdered somebody in 1974... when he was 24 years old, which happened to be the same age Ramirez the Night Stalker was when he committed his first murder. The girl he killed was a 18-year-old German strangled using her bra. He was arrested, sent to prison.
It's not very uncommon, honestly. People do that a lot.
Well, I mean, it would be, it's an easy thing to strangle somebody with.
Yeah.
While in prison, he became a celebrated writer and was released in 1990 with a ton of pomp and circumstance. And everybody was talking about this was a wonderful poster child for pure rehabilitation. He was ready to come out, be a member of society, use his valued skill as a writer, became kind of a celebrity, really. And he was on all these TV shows talking about how he'd been reformed and he was working. Turns out he wasn't reformed at all.
Surprise, surprise.
He murdered a few more women
prison
in Europe.
Failed?
I know. Even European prison. He murdered quite a few more women in Europe. He was not caught while doing this, but he got a job as a journalist and was given an assignment in L.A. So he jumped on a plane, came over to L.A. to write about how Europeans viewed prostitution compared to Americans. Now, this seems like a dangerous assignment to give somebody who's previously been convicted of sexual-related violence.
He's a deviant.
Right, so let's just not throw him in that, but that's what they did.
All right.
In Los Angeles, he checked into the Cecil and started going on police ride-alongs, interviewed law enforcement. In his spare time, he murdered three women.
Okay.
He wasn't working very hard if he had that kind of spare time.
The theory is that they were all prostitutes that came into his hotel room at the Cecil by way of the fire escape.
They're sneaking in, and he's not having any of it.
Well, yeah, they're sneaking in. He's having plenty of it, and then he's killing them.
Oh, okay. So he is telling them to sneak in.
Yes. He's ordering these prostitutes. And
mail order. They're just popping in through the window, though. Interesting.
Yeah. While he was there, he used the same method he had used previously. He was a fugitive for a while and was finally arrested in 92, where he finally hung himself in prison in Austria.
Doing a lean.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty grim. So this is another thing that I didn't know about that happened at the Cecil. In 1995, 14 inmates broke out of Pichus Honor Rancho Jail. I don't know what that is. In Castaic by fleeing through a poorly patched hole in their holding cell. So they climbed over the razor wire fence with socks on their hands. One of those people was Eric Reed, a 24-year-old, who got drunk and told police that several years before he'd smothered his infant son.
Ooh,
yep.
Jesus. Oh, my God.
So that's... Reed, here's the weird thing, though.
With a sock on his hand?
He tricked a...
He tricked
the passing driver. So he's just broken out of prison. Driver's coming by. He tricks them into picking him up by stripping down to his underwear and claiming to have been robbed. The driver took him at his request to the Cecil Hotel, and the guy was caught the next day, sent back to Maine, convicted of murder, Durkader.
So the connection is that he had heard about this legendary place.
Yeah, so the place when he breaks out of prison that he asked to be taken is the Cecil Hotel. Real weird.
I think it's a magnet of negativity.
So Byron, I believe you had a story that happened...
Are we talking about the only dead body I've ever seen?
Yeah.
It was at the Cecil Hotel. I've mentioned this story, I think, several times on the podcast, so I'll be brief.
I want to hear it all again.
Okay, so I just been...
Tell it again, Uncle Byron!
So my girlfriend broke up with me.
Bitch.
And I decided, hey, come on.
I'm just trying to back you up. That's fine. Have your back.
I flew to Los Angeles to do a photo shoot for my clothing company, HindSeatClothing.com. And in the meantime, my photographer was doing a photo shoot with the Utah band, The Used, for a spread in AP magazine. I was assisting on that shoot, and the shoot just so happened to take place at the Cecil Hotel. I knew nothing about this place, but upon arrival, I did know that there were two police officers standing outside of a door in the hallway of the hotel across from the room that we were in. After we got done shooting in the hotel room, we really wanted to use the hallway, but in LA, rules are strict when it comes to doing commercial work. You can't shoot places without a permit. So we didn't want to do that in front of the police officers. So the girlfriend of the bass player of The Used goes out and talks to the police officers and asks them, hey, what's up? What are you guys doing? Trying to get a feel of the situation. They say, oh, we're just waiting for the coroner. A guy died in here. Do you want to see it?
So professional.
And we're all like, oh, what?
Yeah.
Exactly. So me and Burt McCracken of The Used and the whole gang, we kind of line up. The police officer informs us. He says, walk past the room. Don't stop. He didn't want us to stop and stare because that's disrespectful to the dead.
Oh, yeah. You have to have a little decorum in these situations.
So we get in a single file line and walk past this room, and we see the bloated body of morbidly obese man who had been rolled over after he died face down. So all that dark blood had pooled in his face.
Postmortem lividity.
Absolutely. And that moment really shook everyone quite a bit. The vibe shot down.
No more party.
No more pictures.
I was going to say, how the rest of that photo shoot
We were goes. Done. There was no more fun going on.
Yeah, I can't believe that you guys thought that there was going to be any other end result to that, since you aren't horrible humans.
You have to take advantage of situations like
of
that,
of seeing
I guess.
Dead people. No, I don't know that you know.
I'm
with Byron on this.
We don't see open casket funerals anymore.
I don't see heroin needles anymore either, but that doesn't mean that...
The separation between life and death is something that Americans really hide from.
Whether it's or whether it's with grandpa.
I'm not saying that this was the right time for me to see my first dead body, but I think that if we destigmatize, is that a word? Not at all.
I think we should go with it.
Death. It would be beneficial to everyone. It wouldn't have taken the wind out of our sails. It's still terribly depressing that this person died alone.
In the Cecil Hotel.
Yeah.
All right. So now we're up to the most recent big event at the Cecil. 2013, a Canadian tourist by the name of Elisa Lamb, she went missing on February 1st. And on February 19th, a maintenance worker investigated the water cisterns on the roof of the Cecil, which I might add, lock from the outside, and it was locked, opens it up and finds naked Elisa floating in the tank. There are alarms on this water tank.
And why were they looking on the roof?
Well, there had been some complaints, Byron.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Of what nature?
Well, a few people had noted that the water tastes a little bit funny.
A little stinky.
People said it was so bad it couldn't even be described.
Okay.
It sounds like the Cecil customer service is not on the high end. So 19 days into these complaints, they decide, all right, fine, we'll go check the water tank. And sure enough... everybody'd been drinking some Elisa Lamb infused water.
Oh, God.
For a couple of weeks.
That's gamey.
Yeah. It's very sad. So it was confirmed that she had bipolar, but they did not find any drugs in her system. And there's an interesting video that's made the rounds on the internet of the closed circuit camera that filmed her in the last footage of her in the elevator, but she's hiding in the corner of the elevator. She's pushing all the buttons and then she hides in the corner of the elevator. And then she seems to be interacting with somebody on the outside of the elevator who may or may not have been there, but she's acting very crazy. People thought she might be on drugs because this is a rough neighborhood.
Well, and because of her spooky rave hands that she was doing.
Yes.
We've talked about this story a little bit in the past. I think it was when they announced the American Horror Story Hotel.
Yes.
We were proposing some possible situations.
And you said it's probably about the Cecil Hotel, and you were right.
I was right.
You were right. But... the thing is, they tested her body and there was absolutely nothing.
Nothing left because everyone drank. What were you saying? Everyone drank her body?
Yeah, Elisa infused water. Uh-huh. But here's the issue. There would still be evidence of drugs and there were no drugs in her system. Very, very scary. They still have no idea how she got to the roof because you can only get to the roof by taking an elevator to the 13th floor, which requires a special key.
How old was she?
21.
Did I propose that that's a common age for women to start experiencing schizophrenia?
Yes, but that still doesn't explain how she was able to get in the tank and lock it from the outside after she was in.
This is something. What if the janitor noticed that it was unlocked and just locked it after without looking inside?
That's true.
That's a
possibility, but how'd she get the keys to get to the roof?
I don't know. And she did take off all her clothes before she got in. I don't know why anyone would...
But the clothes weren't found.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, there was no sign of the clothes.
What if the janitor threw them out? I mean, apparently, according to that other...
Yeah, Richard Ramirez was able to dump clothes everywhere,
dumping clothes, and the other guy was just calling in prostitutes to pop in through his window.
Right,
so
I mean,
I'm
that's
saying,
true.
Like, maybe the janitor's like, goddamn prostitutes again! And like, just threw the
clothes. It's so much worse going up the fire escape. People are used to whores walking in and out of that place, like, uh-huh. like an assembly line, but... when they start going up the fire escape on the outside of the building, that's going to raise some eyebrows.
Just picture like a janitor with a broom.
Like, yeah, just get out.
Sorry, we're doing some bits.
Yeah, great bit. We have a photo that we're going to post on FrightDay.com of a ghostly figure outside one of the upper story windows that a teenager took a couple years back. And it's very, very creepy. He said he and his friends were standing outside, looked up and saw something very scary. It looked like this kind of almost transparent figure that was hanging out the window. Turns out it was one of the windows that somebody had jumped from.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Took the photo. So we were going to post that. It's an interesting photo. I mean, it's one of those that you can't really verify. You can't really debunk, but it's very cool to look at. And here are a couple recent reviews. It sounds like the real horror for everybody who stays there
is the parking. Am I right, guys? So,
Byron, you didn't stay there. You just went for the photo shoot.
Yeah, we purchased a room and did not stay there.
How much, just out of curiosity, how much was the room?
I remember that being a factor about why we went there. I think it was like $50.
So it wasn't
The room rate is really variable. It depends on who you are and when you come. Like, some people are getting charged $125 a night. Some people are getting charged $40. Very, very wide ranges. And, like, it just has to do, I think they just strike a deal.
Sure. Maybe that's what we did. You know? I didn't really talk to Megan much about it, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, here's somebody talking about their recent stay. This was actually in September of 2015. I made a reservation for the stay on Main through hotels.com. The photos looked decent, good enough for a few nights stay in LA. Before the shuttle driver even dropped us off, he asked if we had read up on the place or tried Googling the former name. He didn't go into much detail and I didn't think anything of it. The lobby's actually okay. There's an odd smell and it's quite hot, but there's beautiful marble. We got the keys to our room. As we left the elevator, we met another odd smell, which got worse the deeper in the hotel we got. Upon opening the door, I walked into a room that was not as shown online. The walls were gross and dirty. The smell lingered. The bathroom was dirty and had stains. The bedding had cigarette burns all over it. I called hotels.com and explained my experience so far. They said that they would cancel it, but I'd be charged a night for late cancellation, even though it was not my choice as the room was unsanitary and the area was proving to be unsafe. Clearly, this guy doesn't understand how hotels.com works.
Oh, you actually, you didn't read the last paragraph.
Yeah, I'm going.
Oh, as I slept, I was woken by a man who smelled of leather, who strangled me and told me to say I love Satan.
Yeah, no.
Are you sure?
I'm sure. I'm sure.
I was murdered, and now I'm a ghost.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
I'm sure.
Okay.
So another person, never have I stayed in such a terrible place.
Sure, it's a bad place.
That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about it because it's a great destination.
This is where it comes to a nightmare for you and Sam.
Oh, no.
The bed unquestionably had been slept in. There were black hairs on the sheets and some other matter on the lamp beside the bed.
Matter? Are we doing matter?
There's two things it is. It's brains left over from a shotgun suicide or it's jizz left over from something else.
Yeah. So
matter.
Yeah. Not a happy place.
Sure.
Not a happy place. It sounds like it really has become one of the frequented spots for not the best characters in LA and then also for ghosts. So I feel bad for the ghosts that haunt there because it's clearly a bummer of a place to be.
I'd like to say it on air. If we ever go to LA Scream Fest or something like that,
we are not going to stay at
I am. I will. And you guys can come hang out at my room.
I'm not hanging out at the Cecil Hotel.
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere near you.
I don't care about it.
I'm going to stay at my...
It's the smell that concerns me.
Oh, you guys are no fun.
Did you just hear me describe the black hairs on the bed?
I want to see it for myself.
You can have it.
No one's fun
here. I don't know. By the time we got done at the last film festival, we went to our hotel room, probably could have been described in pretty similar fashion.
Our hotel room was awesome. Don't you dare talk about the Stanley like that. It was beautiful.
It was a commentary on us, not the hotel.
Monsters. So, Cecil Hotel, everybody can check it out now as it's being represented. Clearly, it's the inspiration for American Horror Story this season.
Part of it. There's a lot of things being thrown into the pot, but it is
right,
definitely...
But Ryan Murphy did confirm that was specifically the Elisa Lam story kind of is what triggered the inspiration for him.
Well, I haven't seen any Elisa Lam yet.
Well, don't say anything. He was just talking about that in his interview. I am excited to watch the new season, and I'm also excited to see if anything else comes up with the Cecil Hotel. I do fear that it's going to be one of those places that's kind of torn to the ground sometime in the near future. It's definitely not gaining money. and it's space in LA that's always worth something. So
it sounds like gentrification's already started.
In that neighborhood, really?
Well, they changed the name.
Yeah, but
they're
no.
pulling all the corpses out of the water tank.
Yeah, they changed the name after the big incident with Elisa Lam.
Smart so
that,
move.
Because obviously they got a whole lot of bad PR with that.
Yeah.
Because the corpse water.
Corpse water, yep. Interesting place, very creepy. I mean, between the Black Dahlia murders and some girl 50 years later getting creepily locked on the roof of a hotel accidentally, it's just, there's a lot of weird stuff that happens there for one place. Whole lot of death and despair.
And I'll post a whole lot of pictures and videos.
Yes.
In the show notes for this episode on Friday.com.
Absolutely.
Check it out.
Absolutely.
Good segment, cool. Kel.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
It's actually one of my favorites. If you can make more murders involved in your stories.
Okay. Well, only when it's tied to ghosts.
More murders.
All right.
Police.
Kelly's Cryptids, Conspiracies, and Killers.
No.
And this has been Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies this week.
So if that didn't creep you out enough, now we're going to talk about some, actually, to be honest, much more fun than creepy, but very entertaining short films sewn together in a wonderful little package called The Tales of Halloween.
Hope you're enjoying your visit here this evening. Now, on with the show.
Tales of Halloween, a 2015 American horror anthology film consisting of 10 interlocking segments, directed and written by LA's most horrifyingly talented individuals. Sam, could you tell us what this film is all about?
The 10 stories take place in a suburban American town whose denizens are terrorized by ghouls, aliens, and killers one Halloween night.
Fantastic.
So any movie that starts out with a radio voice of Adrian Barbeau, it's going to be good.
It's going to be good.
It's going to be good. It was good.
We've been teasing this for a while. I hope our listeners have had the chance to watch this. It's been available on VOD since the 16th.
Yep. Yeah.
And we actually did a live watch party with the makers tonight, where everybody was live tweeting, and
yeah,
it was cool.
You can tell that all the writers and directors really care about this project, especially someone that I didn't really know much about going in, the creator of the project, Axel Carolyn.
She's fantastic. She really curated some amazing stuff with this and had a great idea. I think one of the things we've seen in some recent horror anthologies is they don't really tie together very well. This, I thought, did a great job with the wraparound story and with just the interlocking elements between the different stories in a very, very fun way.
Well, and the cool way that they did that was all of the writers and directors actually roundtabled and talked about each of their projects as a group. They didn't
Yay, collaboration!
Yeah, they didn't just come to it with, here's my idea, like it or not.
Fit it in.
I know Mike Mendez said one of the rules was that your short cannot suck.
It's a good rule.
Yeah, I think it's great.
As rules go.
I appreciate that.
As well as no found footage, which I thought was interesting.
Mm. I appreciate that.
And
well, it wouldn't have fit the style.
Well, and that's another thing, is they all were required to use the same camera equipment so that all of the pieces fit together. So I really think that the way they approached this anthology made for, I think, what we all want in an anthology.
And they actually they came up with a name for themselves.
Well, what would that be? Together. The October Society?
Yeah, which is so cool.
Absolutely.
Don't you wish you guys had come up with that?
I want to be a member
of it. Hey, let's talk about those segments.
You want to jump right on in?
I'd love to.
Let's start knocking them out. Sweet Tooth?
I think this is kind of the manifestation of every child who's deprived of any of their Halloween candy. It's kind of like, you know, in Christmas Story, when the kid has to eat soap and he dreams about what's going to happen to his parents when he grows up and he has soap poisoning that makes him blind.
It was
soap poisoning. Yes, exactly. So this is kind of like that, except it's every kid that's pissed off when his parents won't let him eat all of his Halloween candy.
It was written and directed by Dave Parker,
who I don't really know much about.
And he's kind of a mystery on IMDb.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I love this short, though. It's a great kick into it. It's, a teenage babysitter and her boyfriend pay the price for eating the kids' candy.
Yeah,
it's your
good.
Typical kid's worst nightmare. You go to bed, yeah, and your parents ate all your candy.
I love that the kid in this short his costume was Snape Plissken.
Was it really?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Which is so cool.
And he left a candy bar out that was a Carpenter candy bar. I thought that was a cute little touch.
I thought the kid did great. Yeah. I don't know anything about him. I don't know if he's been anything, but you're right. The Carpenter candy bar, great nod. And the way this was shot, for some reason, it gave me that weird like mid to late 90s feeling. It brought me right back to the, like you said, I know what you did last summer, camera work. It had that kind of vibe.
Or Scream a little bit, possibly.
Yeah, it's a great short.
Yeah. We're going to be falling back on the word fun a lot.
Yeah.
It is just fun.
So The Night Billy Raised Hell, the second short in this lovely anthology, a young boy is about to egg a man's house. Turns out that house belongs to the devil. And that kid is going to learn his lesson. It's written by Clint Sears, directed by Darren Lynn Bousman, who I think wrote, I'm not sure if he wrote them, but he definitely directed Saw 2 through 4, as well as Repo, the genetic opera, The Devil's Carnival, and that film sequel, which is on tour right now. They're doing some sort of big kind of event along with that. Are you familiar with these movies?
With Saw, yes.
Okay, so these are musicals that he does as well, like horror musicals. It's kind of interesting.
That's pretty fun.
You know Repo Man?
Yes.
So Repo, the genetic opera, is a musical version of that.
Wow.
He does great work. It's not really my style of stuff, but I think visually he does some really cool stuff. And I think he did some great stuff in this short. It's a bit wacky, but for a guy that makes musicals...
The hilarious sound effects. It was kind of like Three Stooges
a bit too much slide whistle.
I thought it was very fun. I don't think it was my favorite segment on the anthology.
But what'd you think about the flaming bag prank?
The flaming bag
prank. Let's talk to Sam. Sam likes flaming bags better.
It would have delighted me if it was the standard flaming bag trick, but there was an interesting twist to it that made it absolutely side-splitting.
Pretty fun.
Yeah. I think it is very comic. The thing that bums me out about it, I do feel bad for the kid, and so that's a little rough for me. I have a lot of empathy for the young characters in all of these films.
Byron and I have no empathy.
No empathy.
That's true. That's true. But it was funny. It was definitely funny. There were a couple really comic moments with what's the model's name?
Adrian Curry.
Nice. That was pretty moment. Funny. That was a pretty funny moment.
And then the next segment, we're going to be buzzing right through these, I think. Yeah. It's a late show we got
Good.
Going on here.
I'm
going
to die.
So Trick, where a group of friends who are secretly trick-or-treaters.
Okay,
I'm gonna beep all that, because I don't know why they wrote that down here in the synopsis. It's giving out all the fun.
Yeah, I agree. This one was weird to me. I know you guys, it was definitely up your alley. The premise was so weird to me that I still, for some reason, I just couldn't get into it.
This was the most brutal French New Wave.
Sure. Absolutely.
Of the bunch, I thought.
Yeah, it was Martyr's Light for some reason. Yeah. Stuck smack dab in the middle of this... Pretty fun anthology. I think it works. I think it had some very impressive camera work, and I thought stab technology has improved quite a bit.
So we commented on that. Yeah. I totally agree with you.
Happy Halloween, you f***ing sicko.
Yeah.
So it's a good time. It's kind of the oddball in this.
I don't know. It's a very moralistic tale. I think a lot of them are morality shorts. I mean, this one is definitely...
So they're fables?
Yeah, I kind of think they are. This is our modern Aesop here.
A cool thing in this, I want to mention, they're watching Night of the Living Dead on the TV. The whole wraparound is that it's taking place on this one night. So you'll notice kind of reoccurring things that happen throughout. Several other people are watching Night of the Living Dead at the same time. And as night goes on, the movie changes. I think that was really interesting.
As we work on towards dawn.
The next short is called The Weak and the Wicked. It's where a young man summons a demon to exact revenge on three bullies who burned down his trailer with his parents in it. Directed by Paul Sollett, written by Molly Millions, who I don't know anything about.
Couldn't find anything about Molly Millions.
Paul Sollett is the director of Grace, which is that movie about a zombie baby. It's terribly sad. Very grim film. I don't think Kelly's ever seen that.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, no. I don't think you'd recover from that one. That's a tough film.
Nope, I will definitely be skipping it.
Yeah, this one had a kind of a The Warriors vibe meets Spaghetti Western, The Man with No Name.
Sure, and to me, it kind of had tones of Turbo Kid, but the opposite in the fun level.
It was not fun.
It is pretty dark. Yeah. Turbo Kid is dark, but it still has that kind of like action-y, fun, quirkiness to it. Grace Phipps, is that her name?
Yeah, from Some Kind of Hate.
Which is a film directed by Adam Eachmann Mortimer, a guy that we interviewed at the Stanley Film Festival, mm-hmm. as well as Keir Gilchrist. The guy from It Follows, mm-hmm. the kind of dorky kid that I think Kelly probably likes a lot.
Always.
Yeah, you like those ones.
Yeah.
This one fit the theme the least, in my opinion. For an anthology that is supposed to be everyone in a town at the same time, This felt like a different world.
Yeah, I agree. Well, it felt like a different part of town. Once you said a different world, maybe I could see that. I did get that feeling on my own, though.
Everything else we see is suburban, I guess. I mean, it does say on the other side of the tracks in the intro. Yeah,
the DJ, Adrienne Barbeau, mm-hmm. basically plays the same role she does in The Fog. Yeah, she mentions the hood rats.
Well, and we've got that map, the fun, like, cartoony 3D interactive map that it keeps zooming in and out of. And it shows that you're going to a different part in the city. So, I mean, I think it works. I think it works from that perspective.
I can see your point, though.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
However, I don't think it works quite as well as the next one, which was definitely my favorite.
I have to agree. The Grim Grinning Ghost, which is written and directed by the anthology's creator, Axel Carolyn.
So awesome. I mean, super fabulous, traditional, creepy ghost story.
It had the best cast out of all of them. You could start there.
Oh, my God.
You got Bay, Mick Garris, Barbara Crampton, Stuart Gordon, and one of my favorite people currently, Alex Esso. Yeah, from Starry Eyes.
She's good. She's really good. I know we can't do any spoilers, but that scene when she's walking up to her house, oh my God.
It's amazing.
That's going to be the one scene that I'm totally creeped out with after this movie. You know, when I go lay down tonight, that's going to be what I'm thinking about.
So for people wondering what we're talking about, it's a young woman played by Alex Esso is stalked by a malevolent spirit. It's as simple as that. Cinematically, this matches up the most with what I love. It was shot so smart. It still had that indie feel to it, but it was big.
And thematically, matches up with what I love.
Oh,
I thought this was great. I wanted to be at that party, hanging out with Mick Garris and Barbara Crampton and Stuart Gordon and Alex Esso and Lynn Shay. I mean, it just was like, what a cool...
That's Halloween.
Yeah, exactly. Telling scary stories.
The next segment is Lucky McKee's Ding Dong, who you heard a little bit earlier in the show about this short. Sam, I want to know what you thought about this short.
I liked it. This one was different, and it was less linear than the other pieces in Tales of Halloween. I thought that this may have been a candidate for a ABCs of Death short. Almost.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I could definitely see that.
I'm surprised that. You aren't making a wisecrack about your wife being a witch.
So a man learns that his wife is a child-hungry witch and tries to put a stop to her. Pollyanna McIntosh, I pretty much love everything she does. She is a chameleon. She's amazing. She was in Let Us Pray. She was in The Woman. Those are polar opposite. And I mean, for some reason, there's a third opposite here. She's broken the opposites.
She is.
Amazing.
I think some of the best acting in this entire anthology is Pollyanna McIntosh in this piece.
But while it is well executed, I think it's a bit too absurd for my taste. It's just not that I can't really handle that stuff.
I can't believe that you think that this was more absurd than Trick, but we'll just move along.
It's just kind of a different thing.
Speaking of absurdity, This Means War was a little bit like Modern Family to me.
So a man battles his new neighbor to the death for the best Halloween decorations on the block. Is this a bit of a palate cleanser for the end? Maybe,
it might be. I mean, it reminds me of Modern Family. It reminds me of some Christmas movie, I can't remember, with Matthew Broderick and Danny DeVito, where they fight over Christmas decorations on their street. I think it is very lighthearted. But I do think you're right, Byron. That makes sense just in terms of the progression of the anthology and kind of wiping the slate clean to get ready for the wrap-up with the last three.
In my opinion, this was the weakest piece.
You think so?
I think so.
So directed by John Skip, who was the writer of Nightmare on Elm Street, The Dream Warrior.
And a novelist and editor as well.
So, I mean, not known for directing. which is fine. I think he did a great job visually. It looked fine. I just didn't really think that there was much content-wise.
Yeah, there wasn't much to it.
But that doesn't mean it's terrible. It's just maybe not my favorite segment either. Yeah,
I do think that it did a good job of quieting the pace a little bit to get you ready and, you know, because Friday the 31st.
Well, hold tight. Before we get there, I just want to point out Adam Green, director of Hatchet, plays a police officer that comes in and out of a couple of these segments, and he's prominent in this one in particular. It's really interesting. Sure. Yeah. And the way that they're making this world complete.
Yeah.
Kelly? Mm-hmm. Are you sleeping?
I'm really tired. So
31st of October.
Friday the 31st.
Mm-hmm. That's what I meant.
This one, Byron and Sam both told me I would like, and boy, howdy, did I.
A deformed serial killer meets his match when a trick-or-treating extraterrestrial gets upset that he doesn't have any candy.
Mike Mendez, if you listened to last week's show, you heard a pretty great interview that I had with the director of this. He wrote this with Dave Parker. Didn't Dave Parker, what segment did he do? Did he do the first one?
Yes. Yeah. Sweet Tooth also.
Great team. Super fun.
So adorable. I just wanted to take that cute little alien home.
Just tons and tons of nods to slashers. All of our favorite slashers.
Yeah. But I love the way he framed it. It was really fun.
We've got claymation and some pretty interesting wire work and lots of fake blood. Pretty much everything you need for a good time.
Shitloads of gore. Yeah. And keep your eyes open for a... dismembered Axel Carolyn.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, what fun.
Yeah.
Are you sleeping yet?
Sorry, I'm here. Okay. I'm here.
The ransom of Rusty Rex.
Yeah.
So two bank robbers kidnap a wealthy man's son, John Landis.
The wealthy man.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. John Landis, which is holy shit. Like Landis is in a movie.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Only to discover that the child is a deformed creature that doesn't ever want to leave anyone's side. This creature is played by the late Ben Wolf, who you may know from American Horror Story Freak Show. He died last year after being hit in the head by a car mirror. He was in a coma for a long time. It's terribly sad. This was actually his last movie. I think he did a great job.
Of course he did.
Oh, he was.
Why did they say deformed? Delightful. He's a demon.
He looked a bit like a bat boy. I don't know.
He's just a demon.
He was like some kind of mutated.
Did you see that fucking tongue? He was a demon. Did you see his tongue and ears?
I did.
The tongue was some of the only CG in the movie.
Mm-hmm. I think there was a little bit in
Friday the 30th.
Yeah, yeah, in Mike Mendez's short, but it's kind of a different style.
It's more claymation than.
Well, there's a bit of lightning as well.
Yeah.
Lightning overlay.
Right.
But yeah, this was a cool short.
This seemed like a Twilight Zone episode.
Sure.
Where these two crooks have this great idea to earn some money and then shit just goes terribly wrong.
It keeps happening.
Yeah.
It's fun. I liked it. Not very serious. Are you
Kelly.
Okay? We got it. Fully asleep.
I'm really close.
Stop.
Yeah, yeah. kidnapping, bro.
Yeah.
That's a line.
Yeah.
Super fun. That's just tonally, that's what we have here. It's a good time.
That one had a fun ending too.
Kelly.
Really fun.
You know what's ending?
Bad Seed.
Yeah, that's the ending. The last segment. And it is directed by Neil Marshall, who he's amazing. The Descent, Dog Soldiers, the most important episodes of Game of Thrones.
Dog Soldiers.
No, did I say that?
Are you just repeating that again?
I'm just emphasizing.
Oh, okay, sure. That's
Axel
good.
Axel Carolyn was in this segment too, wasn't she?
She was. And fun little tidbit.
Bit of tid.
They're married. It's so nice.
Cute.
I love horror relationships.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Oh, it's the best.
Aww.
The police officers are back. This kind of ramps into like a really strong segment. I think it's a bit longer than the others.
And it feels like it is.
It feels bigger, too.
It does.
But that's what Neil Marshall does. That's why they have him on the Game of Thrones, like the action episodes.
And this one definitely functioned as the wraparound.
Sure.
It's really too bad that the creators of the most recent VHS installment couldn't have traveled forward in time to watch this and get some hints about how to do it better.
A detective tries to put a stop to a genetically engineered man-eating pumpkin that's terrorizing the town.
That's pretty much what it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a jack-o'-lantern gone evil.
It's crazy how dramatic the cinematography was.
Yeah.
And it's definitely emphasized by the soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
which I know you pointed out, very John Carpenter-esque.
Yeah,
and you know
in
what,
a great way.
Did he have anything to do with Halloween 3, John Carpenter.
I don't think so.
I think he stepped away. But either
I don't think anybody had anything to do with Halloween 3.
Halloween 3 is great.
Everyone's turning around on Halloween 3.
But it has nothing, whether you like it or don't like it, it has nothing to do with the other movies.
That's very true. But that movie does have a little bit to do with a short, as the pumpkins come from a place called Clover Corp, which reminds me quite a bit of a place called Silver Shamrock. Pat Healy stars in this.
Oh, Healy, he's good.
Great sidekick. He stars in Cheap Thrills or The Innkeepers, if you don't know who Pat Healy is. But
and just an all-around fantastic guy, too.
Absolutely.
Christina Klebe? She's in a movie I really enjoyed this year called Proxy. She was in the Halloween remake, and she's in Chillerama. Killed it as the lead. Such a good ending to an anthology. I really enjoyed this segment.
I agree. And it is really hard when you're doing a connecting anthology to find a way to tie it up in the end that feels really satisfying. It is so easy to go wrong there. That was probably one of the most skillful elements of this anthology, I think, was the way it tied up in the end, because that's tough.
It is tough.
And it was really, really well done. I think it left us all with a pretty awesome feeling about the anthology as a whole.
You know what else is really well done?
What?
Is the end of this episode of the podcast.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we're getting there. I'm going to let you go to sleep, but before that...
Okay, should we do our... do we want to give our review?
Yeah, of each segment. So, I'm just kidding, Kelly. Don't look at me like that.
Oh, that was so worth it.
Byron.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't do that to
you. You're trying to hurt me.
I would give this a 7.5. I thought this was super fun. I'm going to watch it every year. I'm going to watch it following Trick or Treat.
Spoiler alert. It's on my top 13 to watch on Halloween.
All right.
Spoiler alert. So sure. Trick or Treat.
Trick or Treat. Great mm-hmm. film as well. Mm-hmm. Kelly, what would you give this movie?
I would give this flick... 7.8.
Ooh, one up, three up in me. 0.3 up in me.
Three up. I think that it's fun. I don't love every segment, but there's not a single segment that I hate. And there are four or five segments that I really, really, really enjoy. It is definitely going to make it on my annual Halloween festival roster.
I'm going to go... What did you say, Byron?
7.5.
I'm going to go 7.0. I echo a lot of Kelly's sentiments. This was overall great. The segments ranged from absolutely classic to pretty good. And those pretty good ones are what pulled it down for me from being a higher score. But absolutely loved it. And it's going to definitely be a part of my Halloween rotation from here on. I feel like there isn't very often an opportunity to add another card to the deck of Halloween movies.
For a genre that comes out with so many fucking movies.
Oh, so many.
There's not that many Halloween movies.
It's true.
Sam, you look like you're going to throw up.
Why you need to go to my list.
Just in my mouth. It's good.
Sure. Oh, God, we're falling apart. It's only been 1 year as a podcast. And
I've aged
Kelly's
terribly.
Dying. I'm dying.
I'm fine. I just need to regenerate.
Would you be receptive to a possible sequel to this franchise?
I think this...
I guess can't call franchise to this...
I think they'd be stupid not to. I mean, this format lends itself to that so well.
The October Society should live on.
I think so. What do you think?
I completely agree. I know in an interview with Axel Carolyn, she was talking about possibly doing it in other places like London, where she lived before, and using London directors,
fun.
You know?
Oh, I love that idea.
I think it's great. I would love to see more. I want to see more from everyone in this. This was a really cool display of LA talent. It's a cool little community that they've built, and everyone like working together with each other's projects. I think it turned out great.
With the response that this movie's gotten this year, I think that they're only bound for better things as far as a sequel, in terms of higher budget, bigger interests, more marketing. I definitely think that this is the ground floor of something that we're all going to look back on when it's Tales of Halloween 18 and say, hey, remember Bad Seed?
But do you think things are going to get as bad as they did with like the VHS franchise? I wouldn't think that people who care this much about the genre would let it slip like that.
No, I don't think so. There's more fodder here.
And the location-based, I think that's such a cool idea.
And that is our review of Tales of Halloween. And as this spooky night ends, I'd like to take a quick second to talk to a ghost.
Of course you do.
In the spirit of All Hallows Eve, which is, I mean, a day where supposedly the dead come and talk to us again.
Mm-hmm.
This is our chance.
Mm-hmm.
What do we want to ask a ghost?
Ghost, will you please promise me never to do anything mean to me because Byron won't leave you alone?
I think we should ask him trick or treat.
Oh, I love it, Sam. Sam wins.
Sam, I hate you.
Everyone close your eyes. If there is a ghost in this vicinity, I'd like to basically borderline beg you at this point to come forth and answer a question for us. And this is an important question that Sam proposed. I know you probably heard it before. Trick or treat? Thank you so much. Happy Halloween.
That's everyone. The dumbest thing I've ever done.
Yeah, it's pretty dumb. It wasn't great. But you know what? That's what you get when you listen to Fright Day.
And that's what you'll get for the next year and the year after that.
I just want to say thank you so much for listening to this show. We've made so many great friends, and it's honestly given us a lot of opportunities to talk to people that we really admire. The fact that you guys are listening, it's incredible. And we're going to cover some really fucking cool movies this year.
Even more important than the directors and actors and producers that we've gotten to talk to, we've gotten to talk to you guys. And that's pretty rad.
This is the best. So it's been an exhausting month. We had our entire month scheduled out. We need to take some time to really figure out what we're going to watch next week, right?
We do. We've got a few options.
Still Halloween, because it's Halloween always now.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. Sam, where can we find you on the internet?
At Sam Fright Day, or email me, sam@frightday.com.
You can get me, Kelly, at frightday.com, or on...
You all right?
Or on Twitter, at Kelly Fright Day.
And I'm at Byron McCoy on Twitter. Byron@frightday.com is my email address. Let me know what your favorite serial killer is. Kelly, you really sparked my interest again.
Aww.
Got off the train. I got off the murder train for a second.
Maybe we should just stick it to serial killers that also have hauntings associated with them.
For all things Fright Day, go to frightday.com, at Fright Day on Twitter. And until next Fright Day, I'm Byron.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Sam.
Thank you guys so much.
Stay with us.
Put your headphones back on. We didn't tell them about your shirts.
Buy my shirts.
All right.
Buy my shirts so you can look as cool and fun as me.
She's talking into the headphones.
Oh my God.
You turned my microphone off.
No, I didn't do anything. You turned your headphones off.
Oh, right. That's what's going on. Did you see how I was really good about that?
No, you're terrible. If you want to support this show beyond listening to it and telling all your friends, which is the coolest way you can support the show, you can go to iTunes and rate and review our show, or go to shop.frightday.com, pick up a Captain Kelly shirt. It comes with
six
if you want.
The holiday season is upon us.
We have some glow-in-the-dark Fright Day shirts. I'm actually thinking about printing some more of those, maybe on a color? Different color?
Ooh.
Color.
I guess we'll see. But rate and review our show on iTunes. I'd love to read your reviews on the show and then send you some cool free stuff. So contact@frightday.com once you leave a review. Thanks so much.